Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined once again by Quinn Kasnick. And before we dive in, I want to thank all of you who checked out our podcast last week for the first time. We hosted St. Bonaventure AD Tim Kenny, and we set a record, Quinn. It was our largest listenership of the year.
I wonder why, but we were on fire, and the Bonnies were with us. And we were on fire, and the Bonnies were with us. So I was very excited about that. It's always good to have some new members on board. So who's next? You said we've got about 110 days in between announcements. Let's go.
Yeah, let's go.
Let's get it going.
Absolutely right. Well, we got to check in with your midweek exploits, which have been diverse and interesting. And this week you were at the McDonald's All-America game.
Oh, I love it. You know, the high school basketball, high-end cesspool that it is. Six undeclareds in the group, four of the top 10 players in the country. These are seniors, folks. They have not declared where they're going to college. They're just waiting though. They're waiting to see who's going pro. They're waiting to see what slots are open at places like Kentucky, Duke, North Carolina, and Kansas. They like to think of themselves as one and dones. This group, I think, only has about two or three of them. It wasn't a stellar group in that regard, but I love some of the big men. You had a bunch of guys who were 6'10", 6'11", who could really run and really play. I was very impressed with Mo Bamba, you know, his ability to get up and down the court, kid from Harlem. Terrific kid. He told Harvard to take a leap. I couldn't believe it. I said, Mo, you know, we got something in common here, my man. I hung up that phone call on Harvard and said, I'm sorry, I can't come to Harvard. And it's a phone call that it stuck with me for the rest of my life. I'm like, you know, that's going to stick with you someday, too. And he laughed.
That's unbelievable. There are not very many people in the world who have had the opportunity to say that. But I want to jump on this undeclared phenomenon real quick. Is this new? Is this something? Or
no.
Am I just asleep at the wheel as far as college basketball is concerned?
You're very asleep at the wheel. You know, again, these colleges are waiting and holding spots. The calendar is such that they don't have to declare for the NBA draft or, you know, going pro yet. So it's a holding pattern. Last year, there were two guys who didn't make their decisions until June. On the women's side, we only had one. There was only one because USC, I think it was USC. Don't quote me on this, but I think USC recently fired their coach. And so that athlete was then left in the lurch. That's the only way I would see this applying to lacrosse, where you'd have someone at the Under Armour All-America game. That's even too late. That's July. But let's say you had an All-Star game in May for lacrosse. And there was massive coaching shifts, a year where maybe three or four top coaches were getting fired. That could cause that type of waiting. It begs me to think, what's going on at Delaware? You know, what happened? What's going on with the 2017s who were signed at Delaware? I guess they have to be honored for a new coach, but beyond that, they don't have to be honored. So I was just wondering how that's going to work.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think that the other side of it too, there's so much, I don't know, uncertainty around this NCAA legislation. And one of the kind of news items on InsideLacrosse.com this week was the unveiling of our April issue cover, which featured a flaming national letter of intent. I understand the mixed metaphor that's going on with this visualization of this concept, realizing that the NLI is not what's in question here. That is a, you know, sacred document and something that the NCAA has no interest in deviating from. The question is about communication between prospective student athletes and coaches and when that is allowed to begin to take place. And I think in mid-April, we'll find out how serious the NCAA is on cracking down on the phenomenon of freshmen and sophomores communicating with coaches and then the correlating verbal commitment that comes along with that and the way in which that impacts a lot of trends in the sport. You certainly have been a vocal opponent of the issue of recruiting.
Isn't the issue here sports-specific legislation more than anything else?
It is, but I think we've already started to see more openness towards sports-specific legislation, not at this scale, though. And that's ultimately kind of the first domino. That's it, like, also like more of a systematic thing, right? Like, I'm not sure that fans care that much about how much the NCAA is willing to dole out sport-specific rules. I think lacrosse fans just care about whether or not, you know, Timmy the ninth grader is going to be able to commit if he's, you know, in fifth grade right now. And I think that the sport-specific nature of it will have long-term implications as other sports pursue their own different types of rules. But it's definitely going to start with recruiting in most non-revenue sports. That's going to be the first thing that they try to tackle, you know, whether it's volleyball, soccer, even hockey, I think is going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, I'm leaning to them not instituting this just because it becomes who's going to police it? You know, they're going to have to do some hiring or redistributing of folks to police this stuff, and it's going to lead to more legislation from other sports, as you just said. And they're not built to tackle these problems right now.
I don't.
They're trying to. They're a business, and they're not looking to expand.
I don't accept that response. I don't accept that response for this reason. The first situation is that the first reason is because the NCAA is a self-reporting body, and so the majority of violations that are reported are when universities realize that they have broken a rule internally.
Gotcha.
And so the second reason is because compliance officers don't know the rule book by heart. Whenever there's a violation, they open the rule book, they read it, and they say, oh, okay, here we go. This is how we respond. And that's why if the rule book gets thicker, it doesn't impact the compliance officer's ability to do his or her job. In my opinion, and I'm not a compliance officer, so I'm casting aspersions here, but like, you know, I do think that it's reasonable to say, you're going to look up the rule anyway. What difference does it make if the rule is the same as the other 30 other sports versus specific to lacrosse in terms of the dates or the machinations of when and who? And the last element is I expect there to be widespread adoption among non-football basketball sports of similar types of rules going forward. And so the point that the idea that recruiting legislation wouldn't be sport-specific, I'm not arguing that it has to be, nor are most of these governing bodies that are putting forward these proposals. They're just asking for something that is more applicable to their sport versus football and basketball. It's basically, let those guys do whatever we want. Let us, who live in a different ecosystem, operate by a second set of rules.
Gotcha. Let's get back to the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of lacrosse this week to discuss. Certainly, we've got some midweek games that we want to talk about. But, you know, first things first, dating all the way back to last week, I want to get your reaction. You talked about Delaware once already. They knocked off the Maverick Media Poll number one, Rutgers Scarlet Knights, in a pretty surprising upset. Kind of reminiscent to the Villanova game in the sense that the Villanova Maryland upset in the sense that Delaware jumped out to a big lead and Rutgers just wasn't able to make it all the way back. Did you have anything on this one?
I have a couple things, and most of it's just anger for the Rutgers people who've been tweeting me for years and lack of respect, and they finally get the number one ranking. How long did that last? I have to say that version of the Scarlet Knights in my history, that was the worst number one ranked team in the history of the poll since I've been alive. I mean, really. Then I got people from Delaware tweeting me like, hey, you got to consider us. Hey, we just beat the number one team. I'm like, do you really consider that the number one team? Really? That's the number one team in the country. That's the best team in the country. That's the best you can do. And you want to, and Delaware will go out this week and lose by 12. You watch. That's just the type of team they are. I have no trust in them. And I'm a little over this situation now where we have teams who inherently can't handle their ranking and they're ranked up high. And it's almost getting fun to watch them crash and burn on a weekly basis.
That's a perfect segue into the first midweek game I want to talk about. Albany 15, Harvard 13. The Great Danes went to Boston on Wednesday night and put on a little bit of a show. The biggest thing about this game to me, and I've got two specific personnel points, but the biggest thing is that this is the type of game that it feels like this Albany team has lost the last 3 to 4 years. And, you know, the midweek game against a quality opponent, but not necessarily a top 20 opponent. And it's the type of game that could haunt them as it relates to that. Do they or don't they host if they win the America East Championship? And so when Harvard on two occasions in the late third and fourth quarter cut it to one goal, I was like, oh man, this feels like one that the Great Danes are going to let slip away. So the fact they were able to take the late fourth quarter by the scruff, open up a two-goal lead, and then basically kill the ball for the last minute 30, I was pretty impressed. I thought they did a nice job with this one.
By the scruff. I love it. I love it. I love it. I used to have a kitty up at Woodstock, New York during the summers. We used to lift the cat up by the scruff.
And I think that's exactly what TD Ireland did from the faceoff X.
I had a dream last night that Albany went to championship weekend this year with Connor Fields, not a Thompson. I mean, it was almost as if someone from the nation was speaking to me, like the apprentice. He's the fifth brother of the Thompsons, and the way he plays, and it was all the spiritual dream. But there they were playing in championship weekend, Albany. The one thing that scares me is that little wrestler they got, the kid from New York who's legit, won every faceoff and still gave up 13 goals on a per possession basis, their defense. And I didn't look at the analytics exactly. I'm sure your friends did. It's very unimpressive analytically defensive when you win every faceoff and you still give up 13 goals.
Agreed. And not only that, but I also felt like J.D. Colarusso, their junior goalie, who was at about 60% heading into this one, didn't even have a horrible game. Now, maybe he was close to 50% overall, but he stole some goals. I mean, it wouldn't have been unjustifiable to be sub 50% in this one. That being said, Harvard's a good offense.
Yeah, exactly. There was no defense being played by the Great Danes. But the dream is a reality. Now, I was taking some cold medication, so you got to factor that into the whole deal.
I was going to say, you're coming across a little bit stuffy. I think both of us are trying to battle through this one.
I'm on the backside of death, basically. six, seven nights in a row of hardcore fever. So I'm down to about 147 pounds. I haven't been able to use my nose or eat in over a week, but I made it.
You're fighting, man. You're fighting. That's a lean. You're down a couple weight classes, huh?
Well, yeah, when you have a fever for 7 nights in a row, you're going to lose some weight.
There's one other midweek game that we want to touch on. The Binghamton Bearcats pull away from the Canisius Golden Griffins and win 11-7 to advance to 7-1 on the season. They're 2-0 in the America East, and we have an opportunity to talk to Binghamton head coach Kevin McEwen about his first year back as a Bearcat and what this season is shaping up like.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Binghamton head coach Kevin McEwen, whose Bearcats are 7-1 on a 6-game winning streak. Coach McEwen is in his first season back at the SUNY's finest. And Coach McEwen, really impressive start to your season. Obviously, America East play is underway, and certainly that will be the focus the rest of the way. That being said, how do you summarize the first 8 games of the 2017 campaign?
Sure, yeah. Well, the first 8 games have, obviously gone pretty well for us. I think, our guys have done a great job, and really the credit goes to them. They've really bought into, what we've kind of set the standard as a new staff here at Binghamton. And I think we're really looking to keep it going and carry it into America East play.
Coming off of an 11-7 victory over Canisius, the attention squarely focused on next game up against Lafayette. How would you say that this roster has come together, and how would you say that your and your staff's understanding of what the composition was going to be and what the chemistry was going to be like has grown over the course of this season?
Yeah, well, I mean, we use the fall as a really learning experience for us to get to know the guys and for the team to get to know us as a staff. And, our staff has done a great job. Chris Cooper running our offense and Kyle Turry, helping with our defense and coaching our goalies as well. Both have done an awesome job. And really our seniors on the roster have really kind of developed as, our leaders on the field and off the field. We've had guys at each position, Garrett Waldron on defense, Tanner Cousins in the net, Tom Moore's obviously done a great job offensively. Tyler DeLuca, who's a midfielder for us and one of our captains, all four of those seniors have really been instrumental in starting to change a few things around here and also, hold their teammates accountable for, their actions.
You mentioned Tom Moore. He's the leading scorer with 25 goals and 20 assists. A lefty attackman who's been highly touted coming out of high school, previous stops at Denver and Jacksonville. What has he meant to this team in terms of your ability to be efficient offensively?
Yeah, well, he's done a great job of, you know, drawing a lot of attention from the defense, first of all, and then he does a great job of seeing the field. Obviously, you know, like you said, he has 20 assists, and you know, he hasn't turned the ball over a ton, and you know, he's really calm, and you know, he gets his teammates involved. I think that's been the biggest thing, and he's a communicator on the offensive end of the field, and you know, just a really, really smart player.
At the other end of the field, your defense is ranked 15th in adjusted defensive efficiency. Who are some of the guys that are leading the way in terms of making the plays to end possessions, getting stops, and getting the ball to the offensive end of the field?
Yeah. I'd say you know, first and foremost is Garrett Waldron. He's a senior defenseman for us, a captain. I'm pretty sure he's outside of our faceoff guys. He's leading the team in ground balls, and he's definitely leading the team in caused turnovers. He does a great job of calculating, you know, the risk of taking a chance to throw a check or put the ball on the ground. And he's also great off the ball and being able to pick off passes. I think he had like three or four against Vermont last week and just picking them clean out of the air. So he's been our leader there. And you know, definitely in net, Tanner Cousins has done a great job. He's saving, you know, the ball over 55%, and you know, just a great athlete, and you know, really focused competitor.
The storyline of the offseason within the America East were program leadership changes. You're one of four new head coaches in the league, UMBC, Hartford, and Vermont, also under new leadership. When you turn your attention to kind of the bully in the room, Albany, among the nation's best teams, they're 7-1, 2-0 in the conference. You are also 7-1, 2-0 in the conference, and then UMBC, another program under new leadership, with an impressive victory over Stony Brook, another one of those established powerhouses in your league. How do you see the America East shaping up the rest of the way as we shift into April?
You know, it's hard to say. I think with conference play, you know, every game means so much. Within our conference, we only have six games. So, you know, we're definitely glad to be, you know, starting out 2-0. And like you said, I think Albany has kind of been the standard setter so far and over the past few years. So, you know, we're certainly a program that we feel, you know, we could be right on par with them, and that's where we want to be. And, you know, I think it's going to be really competitive over the next, you know, month or so throughout April, you know, as it always is. And, you know, at this point, I think it's too early to tell what it'll look like, you know, come early May.
We'll end on a summarizing type of question. You spoke with Inside Lacrosse Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear last July, shortly after taking this job, and spoke about how exciting and to some degree emotional it was to get this opportunity at a place with which we were very familiar. You know, a big function of that opportunity was the chance to do something for the first time. And so how do you kind of, you know, 8-9 months in, meld those two things, you know, both the emotional aspect of the return as well as the learning aspect of doing something for the first time?
Yeah, you know, I think as a staff, we've done a really good job of just kind of staying focused on the task at hand. And, you know, honestly, it's been pretty busy, so I haven't had a lot of time to think about the emotional side of things and, you know, really reflect on, you know, on what we're doing. You know, as a whole, you know, I think something that we're preaching to the team is, you know, one game at a time, and, you know, kind of keeping our habits, you know, during practice, you know, every week, and, you know, starting our preparation for the game on Saturday on Monday. So, I haven't had a whole lot of time to really, you know, take in that larger scale, but it's been a great experience so far. Certainly, you know, I've learned a lot, you know, along the way, you know, from our staff, from our players. And, you know, just hope to keep the momentum going here as we get into April.
Well, with only a half dozen players from not the Empire State on your roster, certainly tons of pride on the Southern Tier. So congratulations on the success so far, and good luck going forward to the Bearcats.
Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear. Find deals up to 70% off on heads, chefs, helmets, and more, or snag unique gear from college and the pros. Sideline Swap also lets you sell old gear simply and securely. List in seconds, and they'll send you a prepaid shipping label when it sells. Visit SidelineSwap, SWAP.com today to get started. Yo, do you have anything from the Binghamton, the Southern Tier region, dating back to your Empire days
yes.
or any of your wrestling exploits?
Oh, yeah. I think I lost to a kid from that region in the States. But other than that, Billy Baldwin wrestled at Binghamton. And I worked with him, obviously, during wrestling. He's a burner, you know, Massapequa guy. He's more of a wrestler than a lacrosse player. But he was talking about the new lacrosse coach last time I saw him for NCAA Wrestling Championships. He was very happy. You know, he's big involved in the fundraising for Binghamton, all their sports. And so they made a good hire. Everything's going in the right direction. I'm impressed with what I'm seeing. And I think it's a positive for that conference.
Quint, moving on, another very significant item on Inside Lacrosse. This week, our midseason All-Americans. We've done this for 8 years, which is crazy to me.
I vomit all over this week for 8 years. it's my least favorite day of the year. I by accident, I logged on to your website, and there you are, video-wise, like screaming at me, "Hey, this is who we like at the halfway mark." All right, okay, great. Great. Let's like next week when the Masters at the ninth hole, I'd love to be there interviewing. Hey, congratulations! You're a first team All American midweek, midway ninth hole Masters. All right, yeah.
No, it'd be like talking about. It would be when on Friday night they talk about all the guys who, you know, have where they finish after they finish on the first two rounds. You know, that's the cut. They actually send people home midway through. What are you talking about?
Well, maybe that's what we should do now instead. Maybe we should start sending people home instead of giving people fictitious awards that they haven't won yet. Oh my God!
So
if I was a player right now, today would be a day I'd go to the locker room. I would be so pissed. I would refuse to let anyone tell me anything about it. I put the blinders on and go to work, just hoping that the game can't come soon enough to end this day of ridiculous speculation about how people are playing.
We talked about it last week with the context of the player of the year watching, so I understand that this is just a repackaging of that same notion.
Did you have three Princeton offensive players in the first two teams?
No.
Do you have Zach Curry or Michael Sowers and Austin Sims on first and second team?
Not Austin Sims.
Oh, okay.
Just
okay,
I
saw an earlier version, I
exactly.
guess.
So the thing I like about this exercise relative to what we do is that it allows you to shine a brighter spotlight on some of the defensive personnel.
And it drives my blood pressure up about 10 points.
Yeah, exactly. I love that too. So let me just ask you this question then. Who are some of your favorite defensive players you've seen so far this year? We know you love Jack and Cannon.
Ben Randall should have been on the first team. Every time I turn on Apple, he's getting run by. No offense to the guy, but everyone who takes him to the goal smokes him. I mean, how many game-winning highlights are you going to give up in a year between Cannizzaro and that freshman from Virginia just torching him?
Didn't he
really? That's a first-team All-American.
Didn't he also have a game-winning assist?
Yeah, he did.
Oh man, that's so funny because whenever you talk to the Notre Dame coaching staffs, they talk about how they like to see their defensive players play defense and they don't care about.
Well, they
told
me who
their
best cover man was, and it wasn't him. Okay,
yeah, I believe it. What do you think of Brett Osmond from Hofstra? Have you gotten an opportunity to see the Pride play enough to feel
no,
like
No, all
you
I watch are the post-game celebrations with Coach Tierney dancing. That's all that's relevant. Their goalie's the best in the country. They got a couple good shooters. After that, this is a team that's on life support.
Last one, the short stick defensive midfield position. You've written about the long stick middies earlier in the year. How do you feel about this group overall, and are there any in particular that stand out to you?
Yeah, Towson's too. Goodrich and Adams, and with Tyler Mays, by far the best group in the country. It was interesting. I talked to Ohio State coming off that 6-3 freezing game where they had to bus back home, and I asked Nick, what's the deal, man? You only scored six goals. You won a ton of faceoffs. He goes, no, that defensive midfield is by far the best that we have ever seen. Those two, they said, they played the whole game. Those two, the 1-2 punch, and then you got Mays at the pole. That's the best unit in the country. Three outstanding guys at their craft.
Do you think that this group is a little bit different from years past? Because it feels to me like there are more teams that are playing two-way guys and specifically letting some of their offensive guys drop back so that some teams are on a greater number of possessions only getting one short stick on. Am I overreacting?
Yeah, no, there's four or five teams who have adjusted that, you know. I just don't see that many hammers out there, you know, like the days of the Laconi and the Hawkins, you know, the way those guys could play both. But they were hammers. Hello. You know, who's a hammer outside the Towson guys? Is Drew Shantz a real hammer? Johns Hopkins got a bunch of midgets running around there. Carolina's guys are big, strong, and fast. Jezokas and Bedard, but they're not making plays right now. I like Cuse's guys. They're actually pretty good athletes. Dukes do not stand. Zenker is not fast enough to be in that category. I don't know. You tell me. Maryland, Isaiah Davis Allen, there's another guy with a strong reputation. Every time I turn on the tape, he's getting beat this year.
One of the guys that got a little bit of shine on this list that I wanted to get your opinion on is Ryan Conrad. And specifically, not just his offensive prowess, his wings of faceoffs, his ability to play defense, but have you seen Virginia fail a clear after the ball is in his stick yet this season?
No.
And that's worth something. I understand that you're only, you know, good teams are going to clear at 94% and bad teams are going to clear at 85%. And so as a result, it's 1 to 2 turnovers a game if you struggle. That being said, the ability to not have the pressure of throwing the ball away is so alleviating for the rest of your team.
When did we get away from throwing the ball to those type of guys and having them leg the ball out every time?
It's crazy to me. He might be bringing it back.
Yeah.
Quint, let's turn our attention to the week ahead because that is the raison d'etre of this podcast. And we are going to start with Friday night. We're going to talk briefly about Rutgers' visit to Hopkins because otherwise the state of New Jersey might find your address and burn your house down.
Well, you know, Jay Alter's got that game along with Paul Carcaterra. I believe it's on the app, believe it or not. 7 o'clock start, and I may be there in person. We'll see what the weather is like and what my responsibilities are like and how I'm feeling health-wise. Hopkins has not had good luck against the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, and I'm expecting the Blue Jays to be a little more fired up than they were last year when they lost twice to the guys from the Raritan River, whatever that is, East Piscataway.
The two high tempo teams. The difference between this year and last year, as far as this matchup is concerned, is Rutgers' defensive efficiency. Hopkins very good in the 6-on-6. You cannot foul the Jays, or else the band will play. The most interesting aspect of this is, does that high tempo, does the increased offensive efficiency negate the need for possession advantage? And if so, how does that correlate to what we saw from the end of Hopkins' game against Virginia, which was an apparent injury to Hunter Moreland that looked very ugly and will impact, presumably, Hopkins' status at the faceoff X going forward?
Yeah, I should find out about that. Good point. I do have to mention, Rutgers, after the 6-1 first quarter against Delaware, they actually played very well the rest of the game for three quarters. They found themselves, they snapped back into it, and if you look at the stats, they played very well. Delaware's goalie, though, was in Fuego, DeLuca, and the mountain was too much to overcome. So I do give them credit. It wasn't a total phone-it-in effort. It was a bad first quarter that they couldn't dig their way out of. They tried. So, you know, Rutgers is legit. This game's a toss-up. This will be interesting. I think Hopkins can be pretty fired up, though. I don't think these teams really like each other very much.
There's a lot of nuance in calling that Rutgers hole that they needed to climb out of a mountain, given that they were being stonewalled by a 6'6 freshman goaltender who made 19 stops. To
your
point about the extra stakes in this game, the fifth-placed team in the Big Ten is going to be just such an unfortunate position to be in, because
five out of six.
Well,
the team above Michigan.
Yeah, basically. I mean, unless the who knows. All right, so what happened?
Well, Michigan beat Penn, so we're down to the Ivy League as a one-team league, correct?
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay.
I don't really see another win on the board for the Ivy League. I mean, you know, even if like Cornell were to beat Syracuse next week, like does that position the Ivy League in any meaningful way? You know, Yale still has an Albany win on the board potentially, but the idea of any individual Ivy League team building an at-large resume that's going to be better than the fourth or fifth placed Big Ten team is really difficult to imagine.
No, at this stage, I see five teams from the Big Ten in without even a debate.
But there's going to be a little bit of tension for that fifth place team because they don't get the additional RPI boost by making it to the conference tournament. And that's where whoever it ends up being is going to be a team that we thought was very good. It's, you know, I mean, logically, like assume that Michigan finishes sixth, which may or may not be a safe assumption. I mean, Penn State's number one in the country right now, and they might be my pick to finish fifth in the Big Ten.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, you're talking about things that are
they're 3 weeks down the road.
5 weeks down the road.
So let us move on to Saturday. We've got the Syracuse Orange heading out to South Bend to avenge a double overtime loss from 2015. And
what network's that game on?
Oh, it's on ESPNU, baby. Noon.
What time?
Saturday.
Noon. Oh, cool.
Yes.
Set your DVR. I'll be setting mine.
Do the extra 30-minute alert in case, because it's a live event, if it goes to OT, which it almost certainly will based on ESPNU's track record.
Based on
season.
Syracuse's track record.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. 6 one-goal games. I got a lot of respect for the Syracuse team. I still can't figure them out. I watched that game in person from the Dome. A, the crowd was great. I would, if I was directing, I would have shown more crowd shots. And then anytime I'm up there, I want to see a little history. You get, if I'm producing, you got to weave in some history because that place is the best. But did the dome have Roe miss that scoop in overtime? You know what I have this, I don't know, that game.
Are your fever dreams coming back?
Yeah, exactly. I got a lot of things to say about that game. I just don't know where to start. Like, Cuse has some shooters that absolutely scare the crap out of me. I mean, Mariano, I want no part of being anywhere in the crease when that guy's near the ball. He can freaking rip it, and he has no idea where it's going sometimes, and sometimes he does. But that shot where he hit the corner and the ball ricocheted and hit the far post to the other post, that was the sickest shot I've seen all year by far. Unbelievable. Love the way that kid plays. The left-handed dodge down the alley where he just takes that overhand shot all over the goalie stick and drops into the far corner. A thing of beauty. It's like watching a club player. But Cuse builds a lead. You know, they play well. They build a two-goal lead. And then all of a sudden, they forget how to catch and throw. Like, when the ball is thrown you on a cross-field pass and you're a defender and the ball bounces, okay, it's going to have topspin. It comes off the turf. Whether it's a shot that hits a defender, goes straight up into the air, hits the post, or lands anywhere on turf, it comes off with topspin. And to see that defender there play that ball off the top of his stick and then out of bounds and then Duke score a goal, it's like, really? You didn't? This is the first time you've ever caught a bounce pass on a cross-field pass? You realize it's going to come off the turf with spin? And then Bomberry, you know, as a point man, to just that horrendous turnover high in the simple fundamental play in a game that had wonderful playmaking. You got the contrast between we can't catch and throw, but we can make great plays, and the lack of consistency had me thinking all week. I almost did my column about it. It's like, how are we so good yet we're so bad? And then you turn the page to Duke, who had a horrendous turnover off a faceoff where an attackman couldn't catch the ball, and then Rowe can't make a simple scoop and cost him the game. Like, how are we so good, yet we're so bad?
The theme of the week, how are we so good, and yet we are so bad. So how do you feel like that's going to manifest itself for Syracuse in this Notre Dame game?
Syracuse is tough. That's one thing that this team is. You know, they brought in the second faceoff guy. He had some success. Their defense is solid. They don't... As opposed to other teams I'm seeing who are dying of self-inflicted wounds, North Carolina, Syracuse's defense hurts themselves less than most, and I think they're pretty athletic in between the lines, and they got you know, guys who can score, Salcedo and Mariano, so they'll go there, they'll give Notre Dame everything they can handle. Absolutely.
Well, you mentioned
the first time, they're going to feel like they're like 6-goal underdogs.
We ask Sergio Salcedo about what it's like to bring this mentality both to a series, a sequence, 6 games consecutively decided by 1 goal, as well as manifest itself in working harder on a week-to-week basis. So let's hear from the Orange senior midfielder. And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Syracuse midfielder Sergio Salcedo, whose Orange are 6-1 heading to Notre Dame, coming off of an incredible stretch. Sergio, your team has played 6 one-goal games, and you're 5-1 in those games. You yourself have been involved in a handful of the game-winning plays, including a game-winning goal and a game-winning assist, a game-tying goal as well. How do you characterize your own performance in the moment and the mindset necessary in order to succeed in those types of moments?
I think just being a leader, you know, in a fifth year and a captain, and your team needs you to, you know, step up and make plays. you know, we work so hard throughout the week and in the preseason just to prepare. And, you know, I don't think we want to be in these one goal games, but it happens. And, you know, you got to look to your senior leadership when it comes down the stretch like that.
Let's revisit a couple of the recent ones. So the Hopkins game in Homewood Field, an 8-7 victory. Can you just run through the final sequence there?
We had run up. Drew up a few plays coming out of a timeout, a couple sets that were maybe get us a good look out of some guys who are good finishers. And, you know, we ran the first one, got a shot off, went out of bounds. Actually, you know, I was really hoping that one was going to go in. And you start to realize that, you know, the play's a little bit broken, and you know, you got a freshman on the field with you at the time who it was his first, I think it was his first career start. So I kind of just wanted the ball on my stick and just took a dodge down the alley and tried to see if I can get a guy to commit. And, fortunately, they slid pretty quick and early. Bomberry just followed, and he was a pretty easy find because you put the ball inside to him, he's going to put it in the net. But it was fun. You know, we lost in overtime last year to those guys down there, and I was pretty anxious just to get back down there and give him the best shot we could give him.
And most recently, a 12-11 victory over Duke in the Carrier Dome. An ACC win, a rematch of last year's very memorable ACC championship game. When the Blue Devils come to town, you know, it's a team that's won three national championships this decade. I have to imagine that it hones the focus, particularly given that one of those national championship games was over the Syracuse Orange. What was that game like, and how do you characterize Jamie Trimboli's game winner in that one?
The Duke is so well coached. You know, Coach Anastasia does an incredible job getting those kids prepared. You know, they're super fundamental and they play as a team. So they're not someone to take lightly. And pending the ACC game last year, we knew they're probably seeking a little bit of revenge coming into the Dome and wanting to get a piece of us. So, you know, we just tried to stick to our game plan and stick to our matchups and really trust each other out there and make plays, you know, going down the stretch. You know, Trimboli made an awesome play there at the end in overtime. I was actually trying to throw the ball up to Nick Mariano on a rollback. He was trailing, but Trimboli kind of picked it out of the air and rolled off his guy and just stepped in from like 15 and let it fly. And it was pretty incredible to see, you know, a freshman in his first career start at home do that against such a, you know, powerhouse team. But that's a good sign for us if a young guy's going to step up like that. So, you know, we'll take it. And, you know, it was a pretty exciting win for the team, no doubt.
Before moving on from this topic of one-goal games and close victories, there's been a little bit of conversation over social media about the term luck and the way that it plays into this and the idea in the analytics community that a team that has the win percentage that you do in close games will at some point revert to the mean. You know, I think that there's some belief that this isn't necessarily localized on any specific team, and it's not a condemnation of your team's performance and ability to win these games. But I'm curious as to your reaction to that idea and how you communicate it through your team.
You know, we work hard. You know, it's been rough for me personally. I've been out, you know, the first, you know, 4 or 5 weeks of practice due to an injury. I wasn't even able to really get out there and work with the guys the full week. You know, getting back to practice and kind of getting a captain, being able to lead a team a little bit more vocally from a standpoint where I'm putting in work with them. They kind of lean towards me a little bit more and kind of look up to me for leadership. And reading those tweets and kind of seeing how people are kind of writing us off and saying that we're just squeaking by these games kind of did two things for me as a leader. You know, I kind of wanted to respond and let people know, like, yeah, it is luck, you know, but we're working hard. And you guys might not see that, or the people who are tweeting might not see that. But we do. We see it every day because we're the ones putting in the work. And then the second thing was, you know, if we're going to squeak by these games, maybe that's kind of a way we've been approaching things and we haven't been aware of it. You know, maybe we are kind of just, you know, squeaking by throughout the week. And I don't think that's an acceptable, you know, amount of effort or accountability that we're going to hold amongst ourselves. So, you know, we work harder now. You know, we're taking the little things a little bit, you know, with a little bit more weight. You know, we're making sure we're not taking any shortcuts this week. And going into a team like Notre Dame, you know, they're well coached and they're going to give us a really good run. We need to be prepared on, you know, all facets of the game.
You mentioned Notre Dame, and I was at the Carrier Dome last year when the Fighting Irish came in on a very meaningful day as the program celebrated its 100th anniversary and put up in one of their most impressive performances of the season in a 17-7 victory. Now you have the opportunity to travel out to South Bend, another ACC contest, and you mentioned, obviously, all the attention to detail that your team is putting in as it relates to the little things. How do you guys regard this rivalry with Notre Dame, and how meaningful is this opportunity to play what in many folks' minds is the number one team in the country?
I think it's huge. I think it's a good game for us, especially at this point in the season, to kind of see who we are as a team and what we're really capable of. You know, they're incredibly strong defense. You know, they've got a lot of great offensive players, and, you know, their faceoff guy is pretty good as well. You know, we lost to them 2 years ago down in South Bend in overtime. I think it was actually double overtime. Nick Costello scored the game-winning goal. And then, you know, last year we have our 100th year, you know, anniversary of Syracuse lacrosse, all the alumni in town. And, you know, they beat us by 10 in the Carrier Dome, you know, in front of all those guys. And, you know, that was pretty embarrassing, especially being more in a high-end role here at Syracuse. At least for me, you know, it doesn't sit well. And I know it doesn't sit well with the other guys. So, you know, there's a little bit extra incentive here to go, you know, go down to South Bend and make sure that we take care of the job. It's going to be a tough game. It's going to be a close game without a doubt, but I'm excited to see, you know, how we shape up in a little bit of a more high pressure situation like that.
Opening up the focus a little bit, but also, I guess, on the other hand, narrowing it, I want to talk about your style of play specifically, because a couple of things I've noticed just tracing over the course of your career. Certainly, you know, when people, you know, analyze your game, talk about your height, and certainly the way that that plays into the athletic profile that you bring to the table. But in addition to that, you know, I think one of the hallmarks of your game is that you're a playmaking midfielder, whereas, you know, a lot of the premier midfielders in college lacrosse tend to be go to the goal and score, whether they're alley dodgers or, you know, different types of wing dodgers. So I'm curious as to how you regard, you know, your responsibility as an assist maker and a creator, as well as counteract that with, you know, how frequently you're going to draw a pull, and your approach to trying to be a dual threat, balance the fact that opposing teams have to respect your ability to score, and then counteract it with your willingness to find your teammates.
Yeah, so, you know, I've always been smaller growing up. You know, I've always been a smaller guy, even in college, you know, than everyone else. So I kind of had to make up for it in other ways, and I knew that. So I wanted to be fast. You know, I wanted to make sure I really put pressure on speed and made sure that I was a good dodger and able to, you know, get down the alleys a little bit quicker than the bigger guys. I didn't really play much my freshman, sophomore year on offense. And that's because the coaches didn't really seem to be too big of a threat yet. The biggest thing that, you know, Coach Donahue was pushing with me was, if you want to play, you need to be a threat. You need to be a playmaker. And, you know, playmakers are going to have turnovers. They're going to make mistakes, but you need to make plays at the end of the day. So I watched a lot of film on guys like, you know, Jojo Marasco, who was an attackman converted to a midfielder, who could dodge and shoot the ball on the run, who could feed the ball really well. He holds the assist record at Syracuse actually now for assists for a midfielder on a regular season. And I kind of just, you know, last year, you know, I wasn't really known across the board. You know, I started to kind of blow up early in the season and throughout the middle of the year, and teams kind of, you know, respect me, but maybe thought, you know, all right, he might be getting lucky. So, you know, they weren't sliding to me as early. They were kind of respecting the matchup a little bit more. You know, now that I'm coming back as a senior, kind of picking up where I left off a little bit. You know, I think teams want to slide earlier, and if they try to trust their matchup, then I want to beat my guy. So I've just been dodging with my head up and just trying to make the right play for my team. Even if I'm moving the ball and that guy's moving the ball onto the next guy and he's scoring, you know, it works for me. You know, my job in the end of the day is, you know, up here is to beat my guy, you know, draw a slide and, you know, make those defenses work and stress the defense. So I really value my individual matchup, you know, going into these games more so than anything. You know, it's kind of like a game within a game for me. I just really want to beat my guy because I know if I can beat my guy, you know, and stress the defense, that, you know, my team's going to have success on the offensive end.
One more about you individually, and it's so much about your story to me represents Syracuse's approach to building a roster in the modern perspective. So two things specifically. The first is the fact that you redshirted, which I think Syracuse has utilized, has been ahead of the curve in college lacrosse in utilizing that redshirt opportunity. And then the second element being the fact that you're from Winter Park, Florida, and how Syracuse, despite so much of its roster being localized in Central New York, has been on the forefront of recruiting nationwide, which is obviously a function of both the brand that the Syracuse lacrosse program permeates throughout the country, as well as the coaching staff's openness and willingness towards examining, looking at guys from all over and giving them an opportunity to come and be a part of the program. How do you regard those two things as it relates to your story and how you can kind of own being a part of this Syracuse team?
I think redshirting my freshman year was honestly a blessing in disguise. You know, I tore my ACL like the first week of practice, had surgery, and was redshirted. And I was probably going to redshirt anyways, just because of my knowledge of how things work and, you know, how offenses click and whatnot coming out of Florida. It's not a hotbed, like you said. And it took me a little bit of time to adjust just to the speed and, you know, transitioning into to Division I lacrosse. So I think that was honestly a big thing for me. The redshirt year is huge because you kind of get to see things from a different perspective, and there's not as much pressure on you to step into a role where you're going to know you're going to have to make big plays every week for your team to win. As a younger guy, it's easier because you kind of get to, you know, learn from the senior guys at the time and the junior guys that are ahead of you. And you kind of get to see what they do well and what they might not do as well, and kind of craft your game or mold your game around that. You know, and the biggest thing with Syracuse and recruiting, you know, I think there's so many kids coming in. There's so many kids playing college across, and everyone has those expectations of, you know, stepping in as a freshman and being the star. And it doesn't always work that way. But, you know, they do a great job in player development, and they keep so many guys, you know, interactive in practice, because it's easy to kind of check out when you're a redshirt and you don't feel as if you're in as big of a role contributing each week. So I think they do an awesome job up here, you know, keeping guys involved and keeping guys on their toes, because, you know, we had a freshman step in, you know, at the faceoff X last week who probably wasn't expecting to play much against Duke, and he stepped up and made incredible plays. And, you know, we kind of asked that of all the guys on our team, to just be ready to go. You never know when your number might get called, and you know, we trust every guy on the roster to step up when their number's called.
I wasn't going to ask you this, but I'm so impressed by your thoughtfulness and your kind of the depth at which you've been able to answer the question so far. I'm hoping that you can help me settle a debate that I'm having with myself. In modern lacrosse, the distinction between midfielders and attackmen is so much subtler than it was back in the day. And for Syracuse, the number of guys that you play in your, you know, top 9, 10, 11, 12 offensive players that can be listed as attackmen and midfielders, whether it's based on what they played in high school, what they've played at certain points over the course of their college career, or where they tend to occupy space on the field, is very much muddling the lines. It's basically you play six offensive players, and that distinction doesn't really matter. The question is very pointed. Is Nick Mariano an attackman or a midfielder?
I think Nick, to answer that in the best way I can, I think Nick is just an offensive player. You know, the kid can score goals, he can shoot, he can dodge, he can feed the ball. You know, I think it just depends on the week and who we're playing and kind of who the matchups are and where we need him most, or we'll see him to stress the defense the most. You know, we put a lot of guys down in attack. Bomberry goes down there sometimes. You know, we bring in Steven Rafis off the bench, Bradley Boyd, who's a sophomore. So, you know, we've got so many guys that are right on the edge of, you know, making huge plays in these games and contributing. And it's hard for defenses to scout because, you know, they're not going to know who's coming in where, what matchups are going to be where, how they're going to slide. It kind of is stressful more so for them than it is for us, because we know what our guys are capable of. You know, I think at Syracuse, with the way our offense is and with the way lacrosse is today, I don't really think there's an attackman versus a midfielder. You know, I think you're just an offensive player, and if you're going to be a threat, you're going to play at this level. So, you know, I think that's the best way I can answer that question for you, and I hope that helps.
It does, except for when it comes time to start talking about All-Americans, and then the USILA needs to modernize and step to, you know, create that distinction between offensive players and defensive players, as opposed to trying to categorize guys as attackmen and midfielders. But, Sergio, we really appreciate the time. This was great. Best of luck and safe travels as you guys head to Notre Dame, and we look forward to watching the Orange as you continue to play these exciting games throughout the remainder of the season.
Hey, Terry, thanks for having me, and I appreciate it.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with a special guest, Patrick McEwen, also known as Lax Film Room on Twitter, Lacrosse Film Room on Instagram and YouTube, and you can find all his work on InsideLacrosse.com. Patrick, we're bringing you on for the first time this season because we just talked to Sergio Salcido, and we asked him about luck, and you and he have engaged in a small exchange earlier this week about the notion of luck, given that Syracuse has played six consecutive one-goal games and won five of them. Can you explain to the audience what reversion to the mean means?
So basically, when it comes to the specific case of like one-goal games or close games, overtime games, the idea is that in the long run, every team is going to win about 50% of them. And so in the case of Syracuse, they're winning, you know, they're 5-1 instead of 3-3 in those one-goal games. And so the idea is that just because they've been 5-1 in those one-goal games previously, we shouldn't necessarily expect them to be any better than 50%, 50-50 going forwards.
I like the idea that you can get better at winning close games because of the way that your team builds confidence through the experience of having been in them. Is there any way to reconcile those two notions?
I guess it's something I haven't studied in lacrosse, but it's an extremely widely studied phenomenon in other sports. And the idea, I guess, is that you kind of feel that way, and it makes sort of intuitive sense. And anecdotally, you know, anybody who's played on a team, you kind of feel that way. But just the reality is sort of that the data doesn't really bear it out, and that winning close games, as much as we would like to think it's something that can be a skill, and that is that a team can replicate over and over, that really just isn't the case empirically.
So when you look at this Syracuse team, what do you think, what do you take away, what do you like, and what do you think they need to do better in order to be better, specifically as they head to South Bend to take on a Notre Dame team, which you've seen play live several times this year?
The big thing I think for them, it's something I haven't done as much watching of him and kind of seeing what some other people might know, is Ben Williams is the same guy that he has been the last 2 years. And that's big for them, because Notre Dame is a team that is used to going under 50% on the faceoffs when they play top teams. It's just sort of a question of how far under 50%. And Syracuse would really like that to be, you know, to be 60, 70, 80%, rather than getting close to 50-50.
Quint, you're a guy who lives on both sides of the fence relative to the increasing sophistication of analytics in sports, but specifically in lacrosse. I know that you and I have debated some of Patrick's numbers heatedly in the past. I'm curious as to whether or not you've got any bullets in the chamber for Patrick that you want to throw at him right now.
For that game, not as much. For the game I'm covering, Duke against North Carolina, you know, my eyes, when I watched him practice, I liked the talent that North Carolina, the Tar Heels, had defensively, and some individuals, you know, Jack Rowlett, Austin Pafani, Kyle Macri. You had some pretty athletic shorties, Jizokos and Bedard. But what I'm seeing out of them is atrocious, quite frankly. I mean, that effort last week, they gave up 12 assisted goals to Maryland out of the 15. Their off-ball defense was as bad as I've ever seen. I mean, poor communication. And it wasn't like Maryland was just flat-out beating them and forcing them to the slide. I thought they were creating offense. What do you have for North Carolina's defense, especially recently?
I guess I don't really necessarily sort them into recent and not recent, but their defense, I have them as a top 10 defense in terms of adjusted efficiency. I have them eighth. But I think my observation with them has been, I think, like you, it kind of aligns with what you were talking about, where sometimes maybe the effort isn't there, or the concentration or focus on execution isn't always there. And I think that's sort of what happened last year with their run at the end of the year, is they lost some games early, I think, because their defense wasn't as good. I had them as a barely above average defense last year, but then they played better in the NCAA tournament.
Quint, do you think Carolina's offenses are more defensive or offensive? Because to me, you know, obviously you let up 15 goals.
When we talked earlier, I thought that for them to be a great team this year, they were going to have to become a defensive team. They've lost four home games that mattered. You know, every time a big team has come to Fetzer Field, they've lost this year, four of them. I think it's Richmond, Hofstra, Johns Hopkins, and now Maryland. And a bunch of those were not close. Their only moment was when they went out to Denver. They got tested. They found this incredible, like, where's that team been all season long? And they won a big game out of Denver. So I still think it's there. I just don't think they figured out how they want to play defense yet. And then offensively, you know, when Tagliaferri, who I love, Michael, he's in a shooting funk. And you have guys who – they just don't have too many guys who can create unassisted opportunities. And then I think that's just cut back on some of the ball movement type goals. I haven't seen a three-pass goal out of them maybe all season.
Patrick, what do the numbers tell you about Duke?
I was going to actually say, on UNC, I think when you bring up the Denver game, what did it, the Denver game, was their offense, I had them going 50%, basically scoring every other time they had the ball, which is why they beat Denver. Not so much, not necessarily the defense. They're just, their offense was so efficient. With regards to Duke, I think they're a pretty balanced team, and they've been kind of borderline in the adjusted efficiency numbers. I have them right now 7th on offense and 11th on defense, and they've been pretty kind of bumping around, being about rough in and out of the top 10 in both categories. And I think with Kyle Rowe on the faceoff, they're one of maybe the 4 or 5 most balanced teams in the country.
That game will be 7 p.m. Sunday, ESPNU. Quint will be on the call, and we will all enjoy that one as we wind down our weekend. A couple other games we want to get to before we let you get out of here. We're going to talk about Richmond taking on Virginia, the Battle of the Commonwealth. The Spiders have yet to beat the Cavaliers, including coming off of getting shut out by Virginia last season in Dom Starch's final year. The closest they've come was a 13-12 loss in their inaugural season, one of the first games the program ever played. And now they get set as a higher-ranked team than Coach Lars Tiffany's squad. The Spiders are marked by.
I got a huge question here for you. I got a huge question here for our stats guru. From a pace standpoint, are these teams not the most diametrically opposed that we've seen? I mean, Richmond's playing about as slow as it gets, correct?
I have them 50th in the country in adjusted pace.
And
so they're definitely
the top
slow.
Five, right?
But yeah. They're not. Well, I mean, there's 71 teams, so they're the 21st slowest team.
So what determines?
But
so possession basically determines who gets to play at their pace.
I think so. But I think to a certain extent, it depends how much teams care about that versus just playing well. I think when you have kind of a, you're right, it definitely is a clash of styles game, but it's something I haven't studied as much as I would like to. But I think you have a case like Johns Hopkins in Virginia just decided to play fast. That was part of the, you know, matching them was kind of part of their game plan. In other cases, you have teams that play slow that when they play a fast team will make a point to play extra slow to try to kind of impose their tempo on a team. It just depends, because if you're trying to play slow, that can mean are you going to give up a great fast break opportunity if it's there? And I think that's potentially, if you worry too much about pace instead of playing well, you start to get into trouble sometimes.
Quint, was there anything about Johns Hopkins' ability to outrun the runner, as Dave Petromala put it, that impressed you or stood out to you, particularly relative to preparing to play Virginia and whether or not the Blue Jays exposed a blueprint?
Where was that strategy last year against Brown? It's the same. Hopkins has the same personnel. All of a sudden, they want to run. They took 61 shots. You know, why aren't they playing this tempo all the time?
I mean, that's a fair question for sure, but that doesn't necessarily. I mean, so you're. I read into that. You think it was a smart decision. You think they did the right thing, and they did it pretty well, at least well enough to beat.
They've tried to run and hide and bob and weave against these fast teams for years, and it hasn't worked. So finally, they got this. So if the guy's going to go out there and run a fast pace, I'm going to have to run fast with him to beat him. Well, that's what you got to do to win the game. They've tried to run and hide, and it's never worked.
Well, we got to move on to our final game of the weekend. We are talking about a pivotal Big Ten matchup. Ohio State heads to Happy Valley to take on the Penn State Nittany Lions. Also 7 p.m. Sunday night, ending your weekend. This is a big one because, you know, I said it earlier in the podcast, I think Penn State might be my pick to finish 5th in the Big Ten right now. When you talk about clashing styles, there's no question that Ohio State, the more balanced team, Penn State, the team that is really reliant on winning faceoffs and scoring goals efficiently. The Jake Withers versus Gerard Arcari matchup is one of the best faceoff matchups we'll see all season. And we'll kick it to you, Patrick, as we talk about this veteran versus inexperienced faceoff matchup.
This is one that I'm really intrigued to watch, because Arcari is facing off at almost 70%. But I think the thing that you see when you watch some of those games closer, I think against Furman and for a little bit against Fairfield, when he starts to struggle, they've gone to Billy Lombardi. And he's a guy that in high school, he was just so dominant that he goes plunger and he wants to take it forward every time. And against in high school, he's just able to do that, you know, 90, 95% of the time because he was just so good. And that's against guys who have some counter to that and can frustrate him. He hasn't necessarily shown a huge variety of moves. And I think that's going to be very interesting to see against Jake Withers, because if there's anybody who is built to exploit that, it's Jake Withers. I broke down some of his moves and talked about it in the face-off ratings this week, about some of the things he did to Baptiste that kind of frustrated him, that Jake Withers is kind of the Swiss Army knife. That guys compare face-off ratings to rock, paper, scissors. If other guys are playing rock, paper, scissors, Withers is playing chess with a number of different things he can do.
Quint.
Yeah, I like Withers in this matchup as well. And I look at Penn State, and clearly this is the time of year where a face-off man's going to start to hit the wall compared to high school from the number of reps, from the scouting report now being out, a guy like Withers and a team like Maryland going forward, and Johns Hopkins has been able to regurgitate that film and really go to work on him. I look at Penn State, and it's simple. I think the teams in the Big Ten that don't have a great face-off game, Penn State beats. The teams who have a good to excellent face-off game, that they lose to. So I would say Ohio State would be favored. Maryland would be favored. The others would be toss-ups right now.
Don't sleep on Mike McDonald at Michigan. Has had some good games this year.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Certainly one game that we didn't get to, but will be very fascinating if something interesting can happen, is Michigan's trip to College Park to take on the Maryland Terrapins. But, Patrick, we want to thank you for joining us on the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview podcast. Quint, as always, who do we do it for?
We work for the fans. We work for the 71 teams. We're working hard right now. We're grinding through some sickness here, some illness here, waiting for the tulips to bloom, and next thing you know, the flower is going to be in the backyard, and the leaves going to be on the trees, and we're going to be playing for championships.
And, Quint, you're a midseason All-American in my book.
You know, hopefully tomorrow I can log on to your website, and that won't still be on there. We can move on.
We'll replace it with this podcast.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.